It's both an honour and a delight to welcome Professor Quentin Skinner to the LSE. Quentin was, until recently, the Professor of Political Science at Cambridge University, and he's a Fellow of Christ's College. But he now is to be appointed the Regius Professor of Modern History. That he has been the Professor of Political Science should make us here at the LSE, with a somewhat different tradition of politics as a science, consider once again what it is about the political that makes it a science. Through his numerous and wide-ranging publications and lectures, he's made the study of political theories and the methodology we use to investigate not only the meaning of past texts, but also their authors' intentions in writing them, one of the most exciting and thought-provoking engagements that any member of the academic community can be involved in. Many of you, I know, are aware and have used with great profit his two volumes, The Foundations of Modern Political Thought, as well as his various writings exploring the ways in which we might best approach the history of political theorizing. In addition, he's written on Machiavelli, on Milton, on the emergence of the modern idea of the state, and most recently, he's produced a major new study on the political theory of Hobbes, entitled Reason and Rhetoric in the Philosophy of Hobbes. In this new book, Professor Skinner examines what he takes to be the central aspiration of Hobbes' civil philosophy, the aspiration to convert the study of moral and political theory into a scientific discipline. In keeping with what has now become known in large part due to him as the Cambridge contextual approach to the study of political ideologies, I have great pleasure in asking Professor Skinner to tell us not only what Hobbes said, but what he intended by saying what he said.
When Thomas Hobbes pauses to characterize his contributions to political philosophy, he generally speaks of himself as engaged in the writing of what he calls scientia civilis, or civil science. For example, in the Leviathan of 1651, he claims that his principal purpose is to create a moral and civil science. And in the revised Latin edition of 1668, he speaks of the dangers incurred by those who lack the scientia needed for citizenship. Hobbes's precise terminology there is, I think, extremely revealing, and it reflects what I believe to be the impact upon him of the classical education he'd received in his youth. Hobbes was born in 1588, and by the time he started his formal schooling in the 1590s, humanist educational theorists of Elizabethan England had already put into widespread currency a distinctive view, not just about the nature of civil science, but about its centrality in the humanistic disciplines. The sources from which they drew this understanding were the major rhetorical treatises of ancient Rome, especially Cicero's De Inventione and De Oratore, and the great summarizing document of the next century, Quintilian's Institutio Oratoria. Now, these treatises were, of course, chiefly concerned to explain the techniques needed for speaking and writing in a persuasive style. But they also embody an explanation of why the acquisition of those rhetorical skills should be thought a matter of cultural significance, of central cultural significance. And part of the point I want to try and press home here this afternoon is that the influence of their explanation upon those who were educated in the classics in England from roughly 1550 to roughly 1950 is impossible to overestimate. It's culturally absolutely central. I got it in 1950. To be an Elizabethan grammar school student was to receive an intensive training in the Latin language. This first involved the study of grammar, that's to say the language itself, hence the word grammar schools. And in the case of a pupil as gifted as Hobbes, this acquisition of the language was at a level of bilinguality. It was a matter of indifference to him whether he spoke and wrote in Latin or in English. Then came rhetoric, the principal subject taught in the sixth form, which was usually called the rhetoric form. Pupils were expected to master the leading classical handbooks on the art of eloquence, in conjunction with learning to imitate the best classical authors. And the goal, of course, was to write Latin, both in verse and in prose, in the highest rhetorical style. Now, to study the art of rhetoric was to study the undisputed masters of that art from antiquity, Cicero and Quintilian. And so, and here's the crucial point, any grammar school student of Hobbes's generation would have studied their views about what civil science is, what they meant by scientia civilis, far more closely than the views of anyone else. And so if you want to understand Hobbes's view about scientia civilis, you will do well, or at least this is part of my argument this afternoon, to begin with that classical understanding of the notion of civil science. And that classical notion is essentially the one that you find in Cicero's rhetorical works. They're not, of course, just rhetorical works. They are works about what he calls civil science. And they're probably, if you think about it, the most widely read works of political theory in the Western tradition. Cicero initially states his view about civil science at the start of his De Inventione, which opens with an account of the founding of cities, which is endlessly repeated in the Renaissance and beyond. Individuals, he says, are the material, the substance out of which cities are constructed, and that material must be brought together in a union of a beneficial kind if they are to realize their highest potentialities. And at some determinate moment, a figure known as the legislator must have recognized that crucial fact and molded this material into that civic shape. And that leads Cicero to ask, what are the talents required on the part of the legislator for thus moulding a citizenry? Or, and he regards this as the same question, what are the elements of a civil science? Now, it goes without saying that for Cicero, the ideal citizen is always a necessary male. And his thesis is that such men will be distinguished by the possession of three linked qualities, which are necessary and, he thinks, jointly sufficient for the effective practice of civil science, this science of political leadership. First, they must be capable of instructing their fellow citizens in the truth and must therefore be persons of wisdom, sapientia. I quote, "Wisdom is so vital for instructing our fellow citizens that I shall not object if you call the orator I am describing a philosopher too." Second, a citizen who wishes to lead or teach wisely must in turn possess high powers of reasoning, ratio, to acquire a comprehensive knowledge of the subjects on which he plans to speak. I quote once more, "Without reasoning, even the most eloquent speaker will quickly be reduced to worthless garrulity." But it's central to his argument that civil science is never a matter of wisdom and reason alone. If you wish to discharge the highest functions of citizenship, that is, plead successfully for justice in the courts and argue for beneficial policies in the public assemblies, then it will always be necessary to move or impel your listeners to adopt your point of view. And if that is to happen, if they are to be moved by reason, then in addition to reason, you must bring to bear the highest eloquence. So the practitioner of scientia civilis, I quote once more, must be capable of arousing listeners and persuading them by the force of winning speech. Notice that pun. If I speak winningly, I shall win the case. To acknowledge the truths that ratio, reason, has brought to light. So, he goes on, This means that a large and crucial part of scientia civilis, of civil science, must be occupied by eloquence, and specifically that form of artistic eloquence which is known as rhetoric, the goal of which is persuading by speech. So notice the claim is not just that eloquence is an indispensable element in civil science, but that the key to eloquence is learning the art of rhetoric. There is a teachable, learnable set of skills, an ars, a technique, which will enable you to speak with eloquence. And that is the art that enables you, and here are the crucial technical terms, to adorn or ornament your utterances as the best means of obliging people to accept your point of view. It's very easy to miss the ferocity of the claim being made at this point, because for us, if we talked about literary adornment, we would usually mean just embellishment. But ornament or adornment are translating the Latin word ornamenta, which is the ordinary Latin word for the weapons of war. And so the whole point of adorning your speech is that it is not embellishment. It is, as Quintilian says, the flashing sword that compels assent. I next want to ask why it is that the ancient theorists of eloquence, above all Cicero and Quintilian, are so insistent that in the absence of these rhetorical arts, even the wisest reasoning will never carry you to victory in the law courts and public assemblies. And notice that those are the two main forums for eloquence, and they correspond to the two main genera of rhetoric in the classical tradition. One form of rhetoric is called judicial, and that's the rhetoric of the law courts, forensic rhetoric. The other is called deliberative, and that's the rhetoric of parliaments, the rhetoric of the assembly. Now, if you ask why eloquence is indispensable to an effective civil science, they answer that it is most obvious in the case of deliberative rhetoric, because there we're engaged in a kind of practical syllogism. We're trying to reason towards an action and not a conclusion. And the action is that the assembly shall do something, that's to say, follow a certain policy beneficial to the Commonwealth. But Cicero and Quintilian are both exponents of what philosophers like to call the Humean view. Philosophers don't in general mind about anachronism. The Humean view that if I succeed in presenting you with good reasons for acting in some way, I can never hope by force of reason alone to motivate you so to act. And the reason is, if I may quote Cicero rather than Hume, because what Hume does is to copy out Cicero and claim the thought as his own, that it is only by supplying you with a desire to act that I can give you a will to act. And so there's one reason why I need, in addition, to have mastered the rhetorical arts, because I must move you to act rationally, as Cicero puts it. And the only means of empowering reason in that way, this, to speak with my own dramatic anachronism, this anti-Kantian view about how you empower reason, is that you can only do so by eloquence. Reason is itself, as Hume says, again quoting Cicero, perfectly inert. But the classical rhetoricians think that it's equally indispensable to forensic oratory to deploy the rhetorical arts. And they're partly led to that view by their very low opinion of the audience that a forensic orator will normally expect to face. In classical Rome, of course, as in the history of this country, you do not face a judge, you face a jury. And that is to say, and I quote Quintilian, you do not face the wise. If you were facing those wholly unaffected by envy, partiality, or prejudice, I concede there would be little scope for rhetorical display. But in a court of law, that is never what you can expect to confront. However, the main emphasis, and I think a more interesting point than the audience, is the subject matter, not just of forensic, but of deliberative speech, is such that eloquence is an indispensable aspect of civil science. An orator speaking in a law court is going to be engaged in prosecuting or defending in circumstances in which there's always going to be an argument on the other side. An orator advising an assembly will similarly often find themselves in the position in which they have to concede that it might be no less rational to propose a contradictory policy to the one they are proposing. The point is that in both cases, there is no possibility, it's excluded, of demonstrating beyond question that one side is in the right. Quintilian puts it, we are speaking of cases in which there will always be reason in utramque partem on either side of the case. for these are cases in which reasons themselves collide. But that means that wise reasoning is never sufficient. It's necessary to win over an audience, but it can't be sufficient, because it will always be necessary to have mastered just those rhetorical techniques which enable you to insist that although there may be two sides to the question, I'm going to be able to move you round to my side. Notice the physicality of the metaphors that lie at the heart of this view of civil science. And indeed, of course, it became proverbial in the Renaissance and has been ever since to say that there are two sides to any question. And that is encapsulated in the way that in modern courts of law and in modern representative assemblies, the space is actually organized. If you think about it, all courts of law are organized on the assumption that there are two sides to the question. And so are many modern representative assemblies. For example, the House of Commons has two sides. It's awkward because there are three parties. Well, there aren't really three parties. And the greatest feat, of course, of traditional parliamentary oratory was to cause someone to cross the floor. That's to say, as a result of listening to your speech, they were so moved emotionally that they moved physically. That's to say, they joined your side. And indeed, this pun on moving someone, how do I move you to my side? How do I cause you to cross the floor? Well, I move your emotions. There is, once more, the Humean thought that lies at the heart of all of this. Well, with all those preliminaries in mind, let me turn back to the case of Thomas Hobbes. You remember this is a lecture about Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes first presents us with his views about what he too calls, as we saw at the outset, civil science, in his Elements of Law, his first work of civil science, the manuscript of which he circulated in 1640, and then translated into Latin and expanded as the first published version of his civil science, which is called, in Latin, De Cive, The Citizen in English, 1642. Hobbes begins in De Cive by stressing, I quote, that like the sages of antiquity, I am principally concerned with civil science. And he specifically names Cicero among those who most prided themselves on their contributions to what is indeed the most valuable of all the disciplines. He endorses the account of the subject matter of civil science, arguing, exactly as Cicero had done, that it is chiefly concerned with the doctrine of public duties, officia, and can therefore be described as the science of justice. And he even endorses the account of the qualities required for discharging these civic duties most effectively. That's to say, he fully agrees that wisdom and its relation to reason are what's above all required. But if you press beyond that point, you not only find Hobbes parting company with, but turning violently against the presuppositions of classical civil science, the presuppositions in which he himself had been educated. And what I now want to show you is that the whole of the rest of Hobbes's analysis of what civil science is, both in De Cive and in its earlier vernacular version, The Elements of Law, takes the form of a frontal attack on the assumptions about the character of civil science that had been put forward by the classical authorities I've so far talked about. Now, this attack is first launched in The Elements of Law, absolutely at the beginning. As we've seen, we could say there are two governing assumptions of classical civil science, and one is that reason is perfectly inert. It has no power to persuade. Hobbes responds with the lie direct. I quote, "My own ambition is to construct a science of justice and policy on the basis of right reason alone. The possibility of doing so stems from the fact that there are two principal parts of our nature. One is passion, but the other is reason. And reason is no less of the nature of man than passion, and is equally and the same in all men. So there is no barrier," I'm still quoting, "to our employing reason to lay the foundations for a science of civil life in which passion not mistrusting will not seek to displace. We can have a science of justice finally free from controversy and dispute." Well, there is the lie direct to the first thought, that reason is perfectly inert. Reason is going to do everything, and it's going to be a demonstrative science. And that brings me to Hobbes's opposition to the other governing assumption of classical civil science, which is their attack on demonstrative certainty, the idea that since there are always two sides to an argument, no one side can ever claim to have established certainty for their case. And that, too, is what Hobbes wants to overthrow. Now, the polemics at this moment, if you think about it, begin with his first title, The Elements of Law. That's an obvious allusion to The Elements of Geometry, which was the title that William Billingsley had given to Euclid's great treatise when he had very recently, at the time, translated it into English for the first time. We've had The Elements of Geometry, now here are The Elements of Law. And so Hobbes's first act with his title is to try to associate in your mind his ideal of a civil science with the most famous work of deductive reasoning ever written. The epistle dedicatory continues in no less polemical vein, and I quote, "I have for the first time laid out the principles of a fully demonstrative science of justice and policy, my argument being such that my principles," now a very interesting word comes up here, "will be inexpugnable, that's to say, incapable of being dislodged by any opposing force." So there's an allusion to the notion that there are two sides, but he says there are not, because nothing will dislodge my side. It is demonstrable certainty. And the Cartesianism, of course he just had his famous quarrel with Descartes, is very evident here. Knowledge is certainty, and what you're about to have is a civil science which is based on knowledge. Now, that attack is kept up all through the book, and I'll just quote chapter 1, which has a wonderful account of this Cartesian picture of a civil science. "Those who say that true knowledge is impossible to acquire in matters of justice and policy merely reveal that they have not well understood their own subject. We can lay down necessary and demonstrable rules about how to produce good and peaceable government. We can hope to construct a civil science, from which proceed the true and evident conclusions of what is right and wrong, what is good and hurtful, to the being and well-being of mankind. We are not condemned to follow those," and notice what next follows, "who have merely insinuated their opinions by eloquence and sophistry. We can hope to write concerning morality and policy demonstrably." So, the elements of law. And if you now turn from the elements to the De Cive, the printed text of 2 years later, I think you encounter a yet more confident attempt, as you see, to challenge and to supersede the presuppositions of the classical idea of civil science with which I began. Even more emphatic in the first place, that reason possesses an inherent power to persuade. I quote, I aim to persuade my readers, not by outward displays of oratory, but by reason itself. And there he actually quotes Cicero's formula in order to reverse it. Cicero had said, you need ratio atque oratio, powerful reasons, but also powerful speech. Hobbes says, we need ratio, but not oratio. Demonstrative reasoning needs no help from the arts of speech. He also reiterates, we're still in De Cive here, his earlier attack on the other basic assumption of classical civil science, namely that you can always mount a plausible argument on either side of the case. He now identifies as the position to be overcome the view, I quote, that in discussions about justice, an effective argument can always be sustained on either side of the case. See, actually quoting the rhetorical injunction. It is true, I'm still quoting, that orators habitually fight with contrary opinions, and then he quotes Quintilian, and say we can only hope to arrive at conclusions capable of being debated. But I retort, so long as we follow the methods of science, we can hope to argue in such a way that no space is left for contrary debates. And this is what I have achieved. This is still Hobbes talking. By contrast with all previous writers on civil science, of whom in truth there are none, I have actually demonstrated the character of moral virtue and the elements of civil duty by connecting them together in a completely self-evident way. Now, although the tone, of course, is spectacularly arrogant, I think it's nevertheless hard for us to recapture how extraordinary that must have sounded at the time. Because what's happening here is an attempt to reorganize the sciences. Civil science, although it's called science, of course, that simply salutes the medieval notion of scientia as an object of knowledge. Civil science was, as we saw in Cicero, the heart and center of the humanistic disciplines, as I hope it still is at the LSE. I hope it is. Hobbes says, no, it isn't anything to do with that. It's part of the natural sciences. It's actually akin to mathematics. It isn't a humanistic discipline at all. And that is the profoundly anti-rhetorical stance which he summarizes. I mean, I think in a moment of brilliant effrontery that I now want to quote to you from chapter 12 of the De Cive. Some say, I'm now quoting, that wisdom can be achieved by gaining an understanding of words in their true and proper definitions, so ensuring that our statements of belief are founded on principles of truth. And this enables us to produce an expression of any proposition or conception in our mind at once perspicuous and elegant, thereby expressing ourselves not merely with wisdom, but with true eloquence. Well, okay, that is, of course, exactly what classical civil science had said. And that was what required you to have mastered the rhetorical arts. But Hobbes says, the key to elegance and perspicuity lies not in studying the art of rhetoric, but in following the footsteps of science. And there you get the complete turning of the tables. We are saying, I'm still quoting, that it is necessary to reason logically. We are not saying that it is necessary to call on artificial aids associated with that powerful form of eloquence which is separated from a true knowledge of things. One of the central orthodoxies in the current literature on Hobbes is that this drive towards demonstrative certainty in the moral sciences needs to be seen as a response to the growing popularity of Pironian skepticism in the late Renaissance and associated arguments of a purportedly relativist kind. Now, that argument has been much elaborated by Professor Richard Popkin and his numerous admirers, but as you can see, it seems to me that it misses the point. I don't think myself that Hobbes was even faintly interested in skepticism. Hobbes is not Descartes. And I've been arguing, by contrast, that his view of civil science is best understood as a reaction not to skepticism, but to the modes of argument characteristic of the rhetorical culture of Renaissance humanism. What Hobbes is trying to do is to replace their dialogical, anti-demonstrative view of what a civil science is, and replace it with a demonstrative science that will transcend the rhetorical. And I think to understand Hobbes's image of a civil science, what you have to see it as is an almost satirical and certainly a l'outrance criticism of the rhetorical culture in which he had been nurtured. Well, so far I've concentrated entirely on the two early versions of Hobbes's civil science. The Elements of Law is 1640, De Cive is 1642. But what about his third, much later and after all far better known work of civil science, the Leviathan, first published in 1651? If we turn to the Leviathan, what view of the concept of a civil science do we find there? The answer is that you come upon an extraordinary change of mind. And I think it's even more extraordinary that this change of mind has been so little remarked by recent commentators on Hobbes's philosophy, although I think the dismal reason for that is that so many commentators on Hobbes concentrate simply on Leviathan, that they've not been in a position to know that the view of civil science it embodies, in turn embodies, a complete reconsideration of what Hobbes had already published on the same theme. Hobbes published 30 books of philosophy, but it's possible to be an expert on Hobbes having only read one of them. Now, the question over which Hobbes most fundamentally changes his mind is whether the force of reason can be regarded, as he'd early maintained, as inherently persuasive, by which, of course, I just mean what Hobbes means by that, which is that if you and I agree about the meanings of terms, and you are then able to follow the deductive chains of reasoning that I use by the employment of those terms, then the conclusions I reach are conclusions that will not be possible for you to gainsay, as Hobbes puts it. You will find that your assent is guaranteed. Now, that's the foundation of Hobbes's view of civil science in the texts I've so far discussed. But in Leviathan, he begins to wonder. And the first point at which he introduces a doubt about this conviction is, as you might expect, in analysing the concept of reason, chapter 5 of Leviathan. Even those, he now says, who understand how to reason are highly fallible. Not but that reason itself is always right reason, just as arithmetic is a certain and infallible art, but no one person's reason, nor the reasoning of any number, make that certainty. But most people, he goes on, and here what he now says directly contradicts what he'd said in The Elements of Law, have no understanding of reasoning at all, whereas before he'd said reasoning is equally a property of all men. I'm sorry he always says men, but everybody writing before 1968 did. They are so far from understanding science, most men, that they know not what it is, the most obvious instance being that geometry they have thought conjuring, where it is in fact the only art it has hitherto pleased God to give mankind. And he also speaks in Leviathan with a completely new asperity about what follows from this kind of ignorance of science. The most obvious outcome, I'm quoting, is that people fall vehemently in love with their own opinions, though never so absurd, and become obstinately bent to maintain them against reason. But even worse is the fact, I quote again, that as we see daily by experience, most people are content to believe any absurdity rather than troubling to examine it. So there's an extraordinary tone of doubt which has entered, which would be utterly foreign to Hobbes's earlier works, a doubt about the capacity of reason, not merely to win assent, but to be a part of our ordinary armoury. And so, Hobbes finds himself obliged in Leviathan to confront some questions about civil science which he'd never thought about before. If the findings of civil science, then, possess no inherent power to convince, because they're findings of reason and reason does not convince, then how are we going to convince people? I mean, what's the point of writing Leviathan? How are we going to win consent, especially from those whose passions lead them to ignore truths of reason? Well, of course, those were exactly the questions that the classical conception of civil science had made central. And what happens in Leviathan is that Hobbes returns, 10 years after his first draft of his civil science, to the humanist roots which he had severed in that first phase of his thinking, and now offers exactly the classical answer that he had earlier repudiated, and, I find fascinatingly, does so in exactly the terminology which is obviously echoing in his head due to his bilinguality, in which the classical formulations had originally been stated. Now, he first hints at this new commitment in analysing the concept of power, a famous discussion in chapter 10. The sciences are small power, but eloquence is power, and is indeed to be numbered amongst the most eminent faculties of the human mind. Not a sentiment that the author of De Cive would ever have expressed. And the argument is developed in chapter 25, in the course of which Hobbes introduces that play on words, which I showed is absolutely central to classical ideas of civil science. The reason why eloquence is so powerful is that those who listen to eloquent speakers find themselves moved to endorse their side of the argument. They draw us to accept their point of view. Well, what, if that's now his position, is the implication for the practice of civil science? The answer is given in a remarkable passage in the conclusion of Leviathan, where Hobbes begins by associating the argument he now wishes to put forward with the two leading genera of rhetorical utterance, that's to say the judicial, which he calls pleading, and the deliberate, which he calls deliberations. And he closely follows the language used by the rhetoricians in their accounts of the skills required for speaking in either of those genres. As we've seen, they'd begun by acknowledging that ratio, effective reasoning, is of course necessary, though not sufficient. Or as Hobbes puts it, here's Hobbes in Leviathan, the faculty of solid reasoning is necessary, for without it, the resolutions of men will be rash and their sentences unjust. But the rhetoricians, you remember, had added that while solid reasoning is necessary, it can't be sufficient because it cannot in itself win round an audience. Now hear Hobbes. I now say that if there be not powerful eloquence, which alone procureth attention and consent, the effect of reason will be little. Well, turning to reconsider that, of course, classical understanding of civil science, Hobbes first observes that a number of writers have rejected it on the grounds that it's incoherent. But what strikes me is that the exact argument that he then goes on to discuss is the argument that he himself had mounted in The Elements of Law and in De Cive. He says, the alleged difficulty, notice he now thinks it's only alleged, whereas before it had been the difficulty, is that if we call on solid reasoning and also powerful eloquence, we shall found our civil science on contrary faculties. For the faculty of reasoning is grounded on principles of truth, but the faculty of persuasion depends upon opinion already received, true or false, and upon the passions of men, which are mutable and different. Now, as we saw in the earlier phase of his writings in civil science, Hobbes did indeed draw the conclusion that that picture is incoherent, and that any civil science worthy of the name must therefore hold itself aloof from the arts of eloquence. But now he takes up the opposite point of view. The right response, and now he now says, and I quote Leviathan again, is to recognize that although these are indeed great difficulties, they are not impossibilities, for by education and discipline they may be, and sometimes are, reconciled, the basis for which is that reason and eloquence, though not perhaps in the natural sciences, yet in the moral, may stand very well together. For wheresoever there is place for adorning, notice the technical term, wheresoever place there is for adorning and preferring of error, there must be much more place for adorning and preferring of truth. Preferring, of course, 17th century English meaning holding it forth so that you're inclined to accept it. Now, announcing that, as it seems to me, extraordinary change of mind, Hobbes again mirrors the language that he had used earlier to mount the opposite case. If you remember, in The Elements, he declared that so long as my readers bring attention, it is sufficient for me to show my reasons. But he now says the only way to win attention is to adorn the truth. In The Elements, he'd concluded that because rhetoricians, I'm quoting, derive what they would have to be believed from somewhat believed already, and in doing so must have aid from the passions of the hearer, so rhetoric must be outlawed from civil science. But in Leviathan, he concludes, that although rhetoricians rely upon opinion already received, true or false, the science of politics must nevertheless be founded on an alliance between reason and those apparently, but not, he now thinks, actually contradictory faculties. Well, there, I think, is a very extraordinary change of mind. And it seems to me natural to ask what could have prompted it. I mean, Hobbes actually has two antithetical views about the subject matter of so much of his life's work, civil science. If you ask what is Hobbes's view of civil science, as we've now seen, there is no one answer. There are two antithetical answers. What caused his change of mind? Well, the key to this puzzle, I think, lies in focusing on what I'm bound to say is yet another aspect of Hobbes's argument in Leviathan, which seems to me extremely important, but which has been rather little noticed in the modern commentary. And this is that in Leviathan, Hobbes presents us for the first time with a new view of human motivation, the implications of which, he says, are potentially lethal to the persuasive force of rational argument. The new contention in Leviathan, which is not present in The Elements of Law or De Cive at all, is this: that even when people find it easy to follow an argument to its conclusion, they may refuse to do so. I mean, an aspect of practical rationality, which is an affront to theoretical rationality, they may refuse to do so if it happens to offend against their perceived sense of their interests. Now, this concept of an interest, for those who may have been brought up to think that it is, as it were, indispensable to thinking about civil science, it's perhaps worth saying, is unknown in English language civil science before this period. The word makes no occurrence in either the text of the Elements of Law or in the text of De Cive. But it is central to Leviathan, and there's an extraordinary shift there, which of course we've inherited, and it's hard for us to work in civil science without thinking of the concept of an interest. But it is a concept that is emergent at this time, and which is, I think, the source of most of Hobbes's doubts about the powers of reason to persuade. So let me focus for a moment on Hobbes's view of interests in Leviathan, because this, I think, is the crux. When Hobbes speaks of interests in Leviathan, he appears to argue that reason remains the force that will guide both public and private persons to the perception of what is in their interests. But he also maintains that conflicts can arise between individual perceptions of interest and a recognition of what reason dictates. And his claim is at that point that interest will then set reason aside. For example, chapter 25 speaks of corrupt counsellors who give advice in opposition to what they know to be right reason because they are, as it were, bribed by their interest. And he later adds that entire assemblies will follow interest rather than what they know to be reason, because in an assembly of many, there cannot choose but be some whose interests are contrary to that of the public. And these their interests make passionate, and passion makes for eloquence, and eloquence draws others to their side. So Hobbes's insight, which is unknown to the author of The Elements of Law and the De Cive, Hobbes's insight in Leviathan is interests contaminate the formation of beliefs. They give rise to a willingness to challenge, on grounds of practical rationality, the most palpable truths of reason. And, as I'm sure you perhaps know, he summarizes in a famous and hyperbolically gloomy passage in chapter 11, "I doubt not, but that if it had been a thing contrary to the interests of those who have dominion over us, that the three angles of a triangle should be equal to the two angles of a square, that doctrine should have been, if not disputed, yet by the burning of all books of geometry, suppressed." So there might have been practical reason for doing that, but of course it's a total affront to the rationality that Hobbes had earlier championed. Well, as you can see, that view of interest as a potential entering wedge of irrationality reflects a total loss of confidence on Hobbes's part in the power of reason in itself to persuade. But if that is so, then it's hardly surprising to find him reverting in Leviathan to the arguments he'd earlier repudiated about the need for an alliance between reason and eloquence, because he obviously felt, as my quotations there imply, that that alliance, although he didn't in himself, I think, ever fully come to like the look of it, nevertheless, that alliance was clearly the only prospect of preventing the demands of interest from elbowing reason aside, because you could always use eloquence in the name of science. And that is what he says Leviathan does. It is a work of eloquence in the name of science. For if reason is to triumph over interest, truth will, after all, have to be adorned. Well, I think, as I say, that's the crux. I mean, and so in a way, that's the sketch of my explanation, but obviously the explanation is completely question-begging. I mean, I've said it's because of the acquisition of a new organizing concept in his civil science, the concept of interests, that Hobbes loses his faith in the power of reason. But that isn't much of an explanation. What we want to know is, well, what happened to prompt all that? I mean, what has intervened between this sunny rationalism of the De Cive and this extreme gloom about the powers of reason in Lewarthin. Well, we do not have to speculate, because Hobbes himself tells us what intervened. And what intervened was the worst thing that ever happened to him. And that was the English Revolution of the 1640s. And he writes a history of the Revolution of the 1640s, culminating in January 1649 with the regicide, that almost unimaginable to the 17th century event. I suppose we could easily imagine it now, couldn't we? But won't fall to us to do that. That Hobbes writes about this in the masterpiece of his old age, The Behemoth, the title of which is obviously intended to recall Leviathan, because they are the two beasts that are discussed in the Old Testament who come from the deep. And The Behemoth is Hobbes's history of the civil wars. I want to end by dwelling for a few moments on Hobbes's account of the civil wars, because it furnishes the explanation to this extraordinary change of mind that I'm looking for. If you know The Behemoth, you'll know that Hobbes mainly stigmatizes two groups as having caused the revolution: what he calls the fanatic ministers, that's the Presbyterians, and the Independents, who then executed the king, and the people whom he calls the democratical gentlemen, that's to say the radicals in the House of Commons. And when he reflects on the seditious character of these two groups, he draws two lessons from their victory. And what so strikes me is that both the lessons are lessons about the role of the art of words in civil science. The first lesson is one that Hobbes tells us in this book. He learnt from the revolution of the 1640s, and it is this: that in a revolution, when it comes to public debate, reason has no chance against interest. That was what the 1640s showed him. And that's what the Hobbesian figure of A, dialogue between A and B, or as one of Hobbes's enemies said, dialogue between Thomas and Hobbes, each praising the other for their perspicuity, is the way that the book is organized. And A, in the opening dialogue, says this, and it's a passage which is megalomaniac, even by Hobbes's standards. Why may not men be taught their duty, that is, the science of just and unjust, as divers others from true principles and evident demonstration, and surely more easily than any of these preachers and democratical gentlemen have taught us rebellion and treason? I answer, he answers his own question, that the rules of just and unjust were sufficiently demonstrated, and from principles evident to the meanest capacity. That has not been wanted. And notwithstanding the obscurity of their author, guess who that was, they have shined not only in this, but in foreign countries, to men of good education. So why has that science, he's obviously talking there about De Cive, been of no avail? Partly, this is still A, because so few people have good education. Partly that most learn, I'm still quoting, learn their politics from divines in the pulpit, the very people who in this instance preached rebellion. But mainly because of the power of interest. If any man had been so singular, as one was, as to have studied the science of justice and equity, how could he teach it safely when it was against the interests of those who were in possession of the power to hurt him? So there's the first conclusion. But the second, which is contrasting, is even more cheerless. Not only does reason prove impotent to persuade, but the most absurd doctrines, so long as they are put forward with a real grasp of the art of rhetoric, and therefore with real eloquence, will always triumph over reason. And there is the second claim that's put forward in The Behemoth, and I think is the key to this sort of collapse of the aspirations for civil science, which, as you see, I think Leviathan represents. Now, that most gloomy thought is demonstrated from both the groups whom Hobbes impugns. First, the democratical gentlemen. I quote A again. They had no arguments on their side. They were men of utter absurdity, but were of daunting rhetorical skill, for they had studied the writings of Cicero in their youth, and from love of eloquence fell in love with his politics, of course Cicero, Republican. This made them great haranguers, and although they never formed a majority in the House of Commons, yet by advantage of eloquence they were always able to sway the rest to their side. They moved them by moving them. So despite the weakness of their principles, these skills in rhetoric were sufficient to betray an entire people. And A then goes on to point the moral when he's describing the first great success of the democratic gentleman, that's to say, the impugning of the Earl of Strafford, Charles I's chief minister. This, he says, was impudence. But impudence in democratical assemblies does everything that is done, for 'tis the goddess of rhetoric, and carries proof with it. For what ordinary man will not, from so great boldness of affirmation, conclude that there must be great probability in the thing affirmed? So there's the democratical gentleman. Even worse are the fanatic ministers. A says that these architects of rebellion were not merely unreasoning, they were in many cases actually insane. But like the democratical gentleman, they were rhetoricians of a terrifying power, for they so framed their countenance and gesture at their entrance into the pulpit, and then in their pronunciation, both in their prayers and sermon, and use of the scripture phrase, not understood by the people, as that no tragedian in the world could have acted the part of a godly man better than these did, insomuch as a man unacquainted with their art of rhetoric, of course, could never have suspected any ambitious plot in them to raise sedition against the state, although they had by then designed it. So to Hobbes, in that later and very bitter text, the English Revolution is, this is what it is the overthrow of reason by the violent force of classical and antinomian rhetoric. But if that's the 1640s, the moral you draw in writing Leviathan at the very end of that decade began after the regicide, began in autumn of 1649. He wrote the book in 12 months, amazingly. The moral is, if you can't beat them, you'll have to join them. And that is the fundamental thought about civil science in Leviathan. If the voice of reason is to have any prospect of being heard amongst the clamour of obscurantism and error, truth will have to be adorned. Well, there is my story, but I see from the clock that there are 2 minutes remaining until we come to 1:30, which is just as well, because I have 2 minutes more that I want to draw on your patience with, if I may, which is to ask this question, which is surely the question you should ask of any lecturer standing here. Well, what is meant to be the moral of this story? I would like to end by drawing 2 morals. The first of them is internal to the study of Hobbes's philosophy. And it stems from my attempt to establish, and this has been my thesis, that Hobbes's conception of a civil science takes the form at all stages of his intellectual career, from the 1630s to the 1670s, of an engagement with neoclassical rhetorical culture. That's what is on his mind all the time. Now, if that's what's on his mind, it's not something that you can read about in the literature on Hobbes, though, as you see, I'm not a tremendous fan of the literature on Hobbes. He's, I think, been too readily seen in the liberal tradition of interpretation, as, you know, the founding theory of the so-called secularized social contract, or the founding theorist of an independent view of rights as liberties, or he's seen, alternatively, in the Marxist tradition as the founding theorist of the notion of possessive individualism. But all of that, and this, of course, is a tribute to his genius, no doubt, tells us about what became of his ideas. He was the first this and the first that and the first the other. What it doesn't tell us anything about was the intellectual context in which his ideas were actually nurtured. And it seems to me that Hobbes has been a victim of teleology, in that it's very easy to make him the beginning of stories, but there is a sense in which Leviathan is the end of a story. It is one of the last of the great works of Renaissance eloquence. Well, that's my first moral, but the second would stem from your saying, well, what of that? I mean, most of us, after all, even I'm sure most of us in this room are not students of Hobbes. What is the moral of the story for us? You're not really meant to ask historians that, because there's something called the study of the past for its own sake, and it's thought very rude to ask people to spend any time saying why it might matter. But let me tell you why it matters to me. And in order to do so, and I see now that it is 6:30, and it's going to take me another minute, I'm sorry to say, but I want to do so by bringing to the surface the three rival views about the character of political argument, which I've tried in effect in this lecture to isolate. First is the view characteristic of the scientific successor culture to the Renaissance. That is the view that Hobbes pioneered in the first phase of his public writings on civil science, namely, that a legal or a political theory should argue deductively from first principles and make no self-conscious use of an art of words at all. And of course, that remains central to contemporary political theory. I mean, think of so great treatises as John Rawls's. I mean, so little does it embody the art of words that it's almost unreadable. I don't think anyone's finished it, have they? Secondly, we have the position to which Hobbes himself eventually inclined, that while we ought indeed to argue deductively, we cannot get away from reason and should not try, we cannot expect the conclusions of reason to have persuasive force. They will have to be reinforced, and the only way to reinforce reason in order to make it win for your side is by adding a self-conscious art of words. And there's the thought of Leviathan, that it is science supported by eloquence, and that's why he thinks it will be of good effect. But thirdly, you have the strongly contrasting Renaissance view, which it was surely, we can now see, one of the great cultural achievements of the scientific revolution to overthrow, namely, that the appropriate model for political discourse is dialogical through and through. That is the classical thought. And so when Carneades came to Rome and he spoke in favor of justice one day, and then the next day spoke against it with no less power, what he was showing you is there is something to be said in favor of justice, but there is something to be said against it. That's what there is to be said about justice, something on either side. So that the inescapability of dialogue in civil science is an absolutely founding thought for antiquity, and why, of course, the moral and political theory of antiquity was always written in dialogue form. So the question I want to leave with you is simply, which view do you endorse? Or, to put what I take to be the same question in a much more pointed form, is it your view that the form of a proposition can be wholly divorced from its content? Now, an affirmative answer to that question has been a founding answer of modern philosophy since Descartes, and of course it's Descartes' view. But against that, of course this is what Descartes stands against, is the founding thought of Renaissance moral and political theory, namely, that no categorical distinction can ever be drawn between the form and content of propositions, because our assent to the content will always depend to some degree on the rhetorical form in which it has been couched, a position which is obviously very closely analogous to Quine's contention that there are no analytical propositions, and hence, as he wonderfully puts it, there is no unvarnished news. So the most general question is, what do you think of that? What do you think is the place of a self-conscious art of words within our moral discourse? And I should like, if I may, simply to leave that question in the air, in the spirit of that memorable passage in The Genealogy of Morals, in which Nietzsche says that he thinks the best audience for moral philosophy in our day would be an audience of cows. But that is because what you should be trying to do, as Nietzsche goes on, is to leave people to ruminate. And so that's what I shall do. Thank you very much.
Says he's quite happy to answer some questions, if there are any, before we run away to the reception. So please do.
Yes. Yes, I think. Yes, that's the opening sentence. Yes.
Which turned his thought more to rhetoric and eloquence. But I can see that there's certainly a great development from the elders of law to provide in that area. But in the elders of law, he does say that it's often reason against the man. So often the man against reason. Now, although that's not a full, long exploration of interest, as he later develops, could it not be the origin and incipient of the
book? Yes. That's good. Now, I think that it's interesting you cite that, because that's not, of course, from within the body of the text. That comes in the epistle dedicatory and was, I think, subsequently inserted. The epistle dedicatory contains the word interest as well. And in the body of text, there's no reference to interests whatever. The relationship of the epistle dedicatory to the text is, I think, a puzzling one. And that's not, I think, a very good answer to you, because I think that, although the epistle dedicatory does puzzle me, because you're quite right that it includes a reference to the notion of interest, and it includes this gloomy thought. The body of the text speaks in a very different voice. But you might say that when he says, you know, the reasons that I shall put before you will be evident to the meanest intelligence. I mean, that's chapter one, isn't it? He cannot say both of those things within a page or two of them. But he does. And I don't have a good account to offer you of that, except this puzzle which I allude to. And what I would want to say, and I think you're not denying, is true of the text as a whole, which has, and of course, there's not even this faint scintilla of doubt in the published version, which is the De Cive. But I'm very grateful for that point, because it does point to something which does puzzle me about it. I mean, what I would like to say is that the Chatsworth manuscript, which is Hobbes's own corrected manuscript of The Element of Law, inserts these later. And actually, that's what I believe. But I haven't been able to show that. It's, as you know, it's in an amanuensis hand. Yes, I didn't know. Desperately learned people here. Yeah. Yes. I'm quite sure you're right. I mean, as often with Hobbes, there's something very Gothic here. You know that Hobbes actually stood as a member of Parliament in 1640 and was unsuccessful in persuading the burghers of Derby to vote him in. And he makes some very rude remarks about this in the Behemoth. It obviously upset him very much. He was all set to do something extremely ironic, wasn't he, which was to present eloquence on the king's side. But it's already clear in The Elements of Law that which is, as you know, circulated immediately after the Short Parliament is dismissed in May of 1640, and the Long Parliament is assembled in November of 1640, that it's the haranguers who terrify him. And of course that's his fear of rhetoric. I don't think he ever overcame that fear. He just takes two different views about it. One is that it should be exiled from the domain of civil science, and that it can be, and that a demonstrative science is possible. And the second is that whatever we may think about it, we're going to have to use it. But he only ever articulates that thought in Leviathan. Though I think the two questions come interestingly together, because he may have had that thought. Yeah. Yes.
Whether I think that he's part of
Well, I suppose that I don't make a strong distinction there. I think that the attempt to reconstruct Hobbes's world historically produces an intellectual universe which is so interesting and so strange and so thought-provoking that I think that if you short-circuit it by going to it with your own questions, you're likely to cheat yourself intellectually. I suppose that's my fundamental existential commitment as an historian. So, of course, my effort is to reconstitute what I thought his own problematic was, and that's what I've been trying to do this evening. However, it is by no means my belief that there's something which is then to be stigmatized as mere history. You've now just told us about 1651. What I've tried to do is to dramatize different ways of thinking about the character of political discourse, because I think that's what Hobbes was doing. And I think it's then something that it's worth, as you said, pondering, as I said, ruminating. Yes. 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 Yes, well, that is right, but if I'd had a bit more time, I would have wanted to say that when I speak about rhetoric, by that term I understand what I think he would have understood by it and not what we would now understand by it. The term has become highly degenerate in that there's a rhetoric of everything. I mean, there's a rhetoric of this occasion and there's a rhetoric of my clothing for this occasion and so forth. And so this is embodied in the thought that everything is a performance, and it's a valuable insight. But it isn't what Hobbes meant by rhetoric. By rhetoric, Hobbes meant that written rhetoric had three elements to it: invention, disposition, and elocution. And elocution meant the art of words. Invention was how you find out arguments. Disposition was how you best organize them. And all of this is with the aim of producing the maximum persuasive effect. It was an art in the sense that you learnt this at school and you learnt how to argue because you were going out into the law courts and the public assemblies of your community. So when he talks about rhetoric, he is talking here specifically about that third element, what they called elocutio, meaning the adornment of words to enforce the truth. Now, what is very striking, if we moved from Hobbes's concept of civil science to Hobbes's practice of civil science, is that the elements of law violently eschews the rhetorical. It is a text of absolutely self-conscious plainness. Leviathan is riotous. I mean, look at the title. It's a metaphor straight away. And the book is ruthless. I mean, one of the reasons it's so funny is, of course, that one of the things that the art of words can do is show you how to ridicule arguments which you're not sure how to overturn. And what else is book three? So I think, in short, there's a possibility of... I mean, of course, there's a rhetoric to Dekive in the sense that there's a rhetoric to everything. But what there isn't in Dekive or the elements of law is what I mean by rhetoric, what Hobbes meant by rhetoric. Yeah. Yes, of course. Reason, yeah. Mm. This is the beginning of the De Inventione, and it's very compact. Reason there... ratio is distinguished from sapientia simply in that ratio names your mastery of a techne, your mastery of an ars, because that's what reason does. And the question is, if you have mastered the art in the sense that you know all that's relevant to it, and if you're also a wise person, that's to say you've mastered the right sort of art, you haven't made a stupid choice, is that enough for you to be an effective legislator? And the answer is absolutely not, because of the third element. But that's how they're laid together. It's just the opening 10 pages or so, those fantastically influential 10 pages at the beginning of the De Inventione. He doesn't say very much more. Sorry? Well, Hobbes in Leviathan is saying exactly that, yes. Exactly that. But not in his earlier works. I mean, Leviathan is a Ciceronian work. Yes. Yes. Well, Hobbes thinks that the more people you have, the more corruption there's likely to be. He thinks it's ineliminable. But one of his reasons for preferring monarchy, which he says is the only preference which is not an object of demonstrative certainty in De Cive, he prefers monarchy, but it's not a matter of demonstration, is for exactly the reason that you cite, which is that the sovereign is someone whom we authorize to act on our behalf in matters about the well-being of the Commonwealth, and the sovereign impersonates a person, and the person is the state. So the state is the name of a person who is impersonated by the sovereign, who in turn represents us. So the question is, well, who should the sovereign be? And Hobbes says, well, you know, it could be all of you, if you like. I mean, we could now constitute ourselves a legal person with a will to act. We just do it by majority vote, and that counting as our will. So he says, there's no problem about that. But much better not do it like that. He says, much better have a natural person be the representative of the artificial person of the state. Why? Because they're less likely to corrupt everything, just because the more people you have, the more likely that's to happen. So that is actually Hobbes's ad hoc attack on democracy in the De Cive. It's ad hoc in the sense that he doesn't think that what I've now said, although I think accurately paraphrased him, he doesn't think he's demonstrated any of that. It's a preference.
Could we have just one more?
Yes. They're not meant to be exhaustive. I mean, they're what I talked about. Yes. Quite. That's quite right. That's absolutely right. That remains with him. There is, absolutely. And I tried to encapsulate it by saying that that Hobbes' own account of Leviathan is that it's a work of eloquence in which eloquence supports reason. It's a work of eloquence in which eloquence supports science. De Cive is a work of science which has no need of eloquence. That's what he changes his mind about. I don't think he ever changes his mind in the sense of thinking, you know, whereas in my first phase as a writer on civil science I thought eloquence was a stinkingly awful thing, I now think it's absolutely wonderful. I think he probably always thought it was a stinkingly awful thing. He just thought that you know, that's life. But where you're right is that the aspiration to write a civil science, where science doesn't just mean a knowledge of the civil, it means what Descartes meant by science. It meant a joining of knowledge to certainty. That aspiration is absolutely consistent. And he thinks that he's done that in Leviathan, he just doesn't think that you'll believe it. Whereas he did. That's the change of mind. But you've made me put it much better than I did in the lecture. Thank you. Well thank you all. Yes. I must say that's been very helpful indeed. Thank you.